Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org.
I'm Fred Eccles, and this is Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. The General Assembly convenes tomorrow for its 60-day long session. That happens every other year when a new budget has to be enacted. So this year, we'll have 10 installments of Assembly Conversations hosted by some familiar public radio names, including Bob Gibson, Libby Fitzgerald, and Melinda Whitstock. Our guests will include some elected officials, the governor next week, for example, some issues experts, some reporters, and some people affected by the decisions made in Richmond. The guest list also includes you as you call in your questions and comments during Assembly Conversations. Tonight, we'll preview the session and some of the issues that will likely be getting close attention over the next couple of months. And we'll start with something that happened today in Richmond. House of Delegates Democrats say they'll push for creation of a state health insurance exchange during this session of the Assembly. The Democrats say such a marketplace for insurance policies is coming sooner or later, and as Virginia Public Radio's Anne Marie Morgan reports, they say they'd like to be able to choose which government will run it.
The federal health care law mandates an exchange for each state, but each could be overseen by the state or the federal government. House Democrats say that even if the U.S. Supreme Court strikes down part or all of the law, a state-run exchange is just good public policy and will produce more competition between insurance companies and perhaps lower prices. Arlington Delegate Patrick Hope is sponsoring one of the bills to expedite its creation.
Is it going to be housed here in Richmond, overseen by our Department of Health and Human Resources, or is it going to be overseen in the Hubert Humphrey Building on Independence Avenue in Washington, D.C.? I think that's the real threat. And waiting and not sending a strong signal to the Secretary of Health and Human Resources that we intend to do this is dangerous, because we really are threatening the fact whether Virginia has sole control of operating this exchange.
Some Republicans have said they will file their own legislation, but GOP lawmakers have not yet reached a consensus on whether or when to create an exchange. Reporting from Richmond, I'm Anne Marie Morgan.
Bob Gibson will be back this year to host half our Assembly Conversations programs, including our show next week. Bob joins us on the phone. Bob, are Democrats still holding out any hope that the Senate can be organized without Lieutenant Governor Bill Bowling breaking tie votes in favor of the Republicans?
I'd say it's a slim chance that the Democrats have at this point. The opinions that are lining up are on both sides of the issue, but the Republicans have enough opinions that seem to say that a 2020 vote with a tiebreaker in many instances, even though the Lieutenant Governor can't vote on the budget, will be enough to organize.
Bob, the Senate, of course, was instrumental in blocking a number of Republican legislative initiatives last year that never got out of Senate committees. How dramatic a change is there going to be, do you think, in this Senate? How much different a result can Republicans expect?
I'm not sure it's as dramatic as people feel it may be or fear it may be, because there are many, many factors involved in Senate votes, including regional interests and individual interests, and not everything down there is as partisan as one might think.
So you don't think we should be expecting a lot of party-line votes?
I think on issues such as transportation, the budget, many factors factor in, including regional interests, that rise above and beyond partisanship at many times. So it's going to be difficult to find a lot of 2020 votes, although I'm sure they'll find some to put Lieutenant Governor Bowling on the spot.
Bob, what are some particular issues you'll be keeping your eye on that you think might be at the center of the action this year?
I think the most contentious part may be the attempt to increase the share of sales tax gradually, year by year for 8 years, to transportation funding, to take more funding from the general fund pool and put it in the transportation fund, disadvantage the fund that funds education across Virginia.
Well, we're accustomed to sessions ending with lots of people dissatisfied about transportation funding. Will that be any different this time?
I think there are more needs than there are dollars, so finding the dollars to meet the needs is going to be a very difficult proposition in this session. We have not reached a point where either body is willing to really increase revenue by a great deal.
There's also the Virginia retirement system, which has at least a published funding shortfall of $15 to $20 billion. How much attention do you think that's going to require?
It appears that the governor is going to prevail in putting more money into the VRS because for a long time now, localities in the state have been dipping into the fund to balance budgets, and it's time that the fund be replenished. It's going to take a long time to fully replenish that fund, and he's making a start on it, the governor is, in this budget. But it's a very difficult thing to do when you have current needs that aren't being met.
Well, let's get back to Lieutenant Governor Bowling and his duty of casting tie-breaking votes. It appears likely that he wants to run for governor and that his fellow Republican, Ken Cuccinelli, wants to run for governor, and certainly some Democrat will want to run for governor. Are we going to see the Senate forces in the Senate trying to maneuver the lieutenant governor into casting certain votes that they can use against him later on?
This thing does kind of happen that way, and it'll happen to Bowling as the man in the middle from both sides. Attorney General Cuccinelli, his rival for the Republican nomination for governor in 2013 next year, will be trying to get some votes on the record to make the lieutenant governor contrast with the more conservative Cuccinelli record, perhaps. And the Democrats will be trying to get the lieutenant governor on the record, casting tiebreakers on issues that they think they have an advantage on. So I think while some senators may be asked to avoid a 2020 tie and cast a ballot to avoid a tie, there will be instances where Bowling can be surprised or can anticipate votes from either side that might put him on the spot.
So this could be a mixed blessing for Bill Bowling, then?
Well, the increased visibility, as long as people spell his name right, will probably be a net plus as far as his visibility for the governorship. But there can be some embarrassing moments, and he can be put on the spot in ways that he perhaps wouldn't want to be.
Bob, what do you think are the things we'll spend the next 2 months talking about most?
Well, transportation is going to be a big issue, as is uranium mining. It looks like on the uranium mining issue, there may be a consensus growing to put it off for a year because of the federal study that was just released in December. So perhaps the most divisive issue, uranium mining in the Assembly this upcoming session, can be put off at least 1 year. But on transportation funding, there will never be enough money in this session to satisfy transportation needs. And there will be some attempts to dip into the general fund to increase the money for transportation funding, and that will be bitterly resisted. So I think there'll be a major battle over the budget in transportation. It's good to see the governor's budget include a few little nuggets around the margins, such as increased funding for the train that goes from Lynchburg to Charlottesville to Washington every day, which is a very successful Amtrak venture, and perhaps can be extended someday down to Danville.
And a week from tonight, Bob, you and Assembly Conversations listeners will have a chance to talk with the governor.
Next Tuesday, the governor will be on from 7 to 8 p.m., coming to the studios in Richmond to take phone calls from across Virginia. And I hope we have a good number of people asking good policy questions of Governor McDonnell.
Bob Gibson, who will be hosting some of our Assembly Conversation shows, including 1 week from tonight with Governor Bob McDonnell, and we hope you'll be with us for that one. This is Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. I'm Fred Eccles, and I will go ahead and mention that coming up on the 24th, Libby Fitzgerald will host Assembly Conversations. And she will welcome to the studio in Richmond several local government officials who will talk about the relationship between localities and the General Assembly and how things done in Richmond, and I guess things not done in Richmond, affect local governments. Then on January 31st, 2 weeks from tonight, Lieutenant Governor Bill Bowling will be our guest on Assembly Conversations. As the legislature gears up for a session that will run through March 10th, environmentalists are hoping state lawmakers will vote green. Sandy Houseman talked with staffers at the Southern Environmental Law Center in Charlottesville about the issues and policies they'll be pushing in Richmond.
At the top of Cale Jaffe's list is maintaining a ban on uranium mining. A senior attorney for the Southern Environmental Law Center, he says less than 1% of what miners could get from the ground in Pennsylvania County could be used to generate nuclear power. The rest would be radioactive waste.
Only 0.06% of the rock that they've got there has the uranium product that they're looking for. 99.4% is uranium waste. So a huge problem with uranium mining is how do you manage all of that waste, which retains 85% of the radioactivity of the original deposit.
The uranium would be sent out of state for enrichment and sale on the world market, so there's no guarantee that Virginia utilities could use it. But Jaffe says we'd be stuck with the risk of storing radioactive waste.
Basically what happens is you dig the ore out of the ground, you have to crush it, use a chemical process to extract what will become yellow cake out of the rock. And then you have all of that chemical solution, the waste rock, the radioactivity, all of that has to be landfilled and maintained here.
Mining would generate jobs in part of the state that desperately needs economic development. But Jaffe says this opportunity is not worth the risk.
In Florida, there was a phosphate company that was mining uranium as a byproduct. That company went bankrupt. And the state was left holding the bag for more than $100 million of cleanup costs. A 500,000-gallon spill in Canada, contamination that continues to persist downstream in France more than 25 years after mines have closed, serious contamination problems in Florida and Louisiana that have landed those states high on the list of toxic releases measured by EPA. If you look around and you've seen spills in case after case after case, and we know Virginia is subject to hurricanes and has a high water table, why do we think it would go better here? A lot of South Side legislators, those closest to the deposit, have come out publicly in support of maintaining the ban.
He worries, however, that lawmakers from other parts of the state might vote to lift the ban on mining uranium because a company that would profit has been spreading money around Richmond.
I looked at the public records myself, and very conservatively, it looks like they're spending at least $660,000 lobbying the General Assembly members. They've flown several of them to France to visit former mine sites, but also to enjoy France in the summertime. They've given thousands of dollars to party leaders on both sides. There's no doubt that they've hired major lobbying firms. So there's no doubt that they are putting a full court press to try to lift the ban.
He also hopes legislators will revise a law first passed in 2007. It provides incentives to power companies that generate a certain percentage of their electricity using renewable resources.
The purpose of the law was to try to spur the development of green energy jobs here in Virginia, building wind off Virginia's coast, building solar.
But Dominion Power is collecting incentives for a much older source, water.
There are a lot of old dams throughout our electricity grid, some of which were built in the early 1900s. Those facilities continue to generate a little bit of electricity. So all that the utilities have to do is purchase enough megawatt hours from these old facilities and then apply that in Virginia.
He adds that Dominion passed on the opportunity to develop wind energy in this part of the world.
There was a wind project that's been proposed by a Spanish firm in eastern North Carolina, just below the Virginia border. I think the firm's name is Iberdrola. They looked to Dominion to see if Dominion would be interested in buying the power. Dominion said no.
Trip Pollard hopes lawmakers will say yes to more rail transit for people and cargo in Virginia. The director of SELC's Land and Community Program wants a better balance between mass transit and roads. The governor's budget for 2013 and 14 does support trains.
There is some additional funding for rail that we think is very important for passenger rail. What we were actually hoping to see was a dedicated permanent source of funding, because this is going to be an issue year in and year out. And this is at a time when we're seeing record Amtrak ridership nationwide, and in fact, two of the three fastest growing routes in the whole country were in Virginia last year.
And he blasts plans for two new roads, the 29 bypass around Charlottesville and a new Route 460 in Southside.
These are roads that are very costly, very destructive, and we believe that it's not either environmentally or fiscally prudent to pursue these projects.
Pollard hopes lawmakers will retain a requirement approved under Governor Tim Kaine that fast-growing communities concentrate new development in areas already served by roads and mass transit.
That passed in 2007 with bipartisan support. It was strengthened a couple of years later, and there's now a proposal that's already been introduced that would gut that requirement and just make it something that counties could do instead of that they had to do.
And finally, he worries about a growing reliance on the state's general fund to pay for highways and mass transit.
Transportation is then taking money that otherwise could be used for not only environmental issues, but schools, police, fire protection, a whole host of other needs.
The Southern Environmental Law Center says Virginia should consider an increase in taxes on gasoline and rental cars. But first, noting the state is spending $4 billion on transit, Trip Pollard says we need to spend that money more wisely. This is Sandy Houseman reporting.
This is Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. I'm Fred Eccles. One person who takes a different view of uranium mining, not surprisingly, is Patrick Wales. He works for Virginia Uranium, and he's project manager of the effort to open a mine in Pennsylvania County. He says he found encouragement in the National Academy of Sciences report.
Well, I think it's a comprehensive report, and I think there's two main things that we have focused on. One is that there's a clear roadmap in the report that lays out how Virginia would need to go about the process of drafting regulations and including the public in that process. It's a very clear roadmap. And then two, it describes in detail many of the best management practices that are used internationally today that have proven effective in ensuring environmental protection in the uranium mining and milling industry.
Well, around the offices of Virginia Uranium, is that report seen as encouraging, discouraging, neutral?
I think that we were very encouraged. In fact, the timeline that is laid out in the National Academy of Sciences study is very consistent with the timeline that we have been anticipating. They laid out basically a 5 to 8 year time frame from the point at which Virginia decides to move forward with this, that it's a very lengthy process. And the National Academy of Sciences study recommends that the public be involved in that process at every step of the way, and that's something that we've been committed to from the very beginning and something that we welcome. So I think overall, when you combine the best management practices that are highlighted in the study with the clear roadmap that they lay out for the Commonwealth, that there's a strong foundation. And keep in mind as well, Fred, that this is but one piece of the 30-year body of evidence that the Commonwealth has gotten on this topic. And if you recall, the conclusions of the studies in the 1980s that the state commissioned were that the moratorium could be lifted and that the regulatory framework should be established. And also, the National Academy of Sciences points out that many of the risks that they describe, and it's very appropriate to discuss the risks, but many of the risks that they describe, specifically in Chapters 5 and in Chapters 6 of the report, are from a time in which uranium mining and milling practices were done under conditions that would not be acceptable today. So it's important to know where we came from, but I think it's equally important to know the reality of today. And the reality of today is that uranium mines, say, in Canada are some of the is one of the safest industries that operates in that country.
But do you think that's what Virginians perceive? Is that the message that's getting across to people?
I think it is getting across effectively, and in fact, recent statewide polling has shown that there's a slight majority of people that support this. And I think that there's probably still quite a few people in the middle that would like to understand the issue better, and we're committed to doing that and to getting out and explaining our story and how we feel like the National Academy of Sciences study backs up many of the things that we've been saying, the best management practices that we intend to use. But there's always going to be more work to be done, and so we're still committed to spreading that message and to telling our remarkable story about how we can reduce our nation's dependence on foreign energy, and we can do that while putting Southside Virginians back to work. And all the socioeconomic studies that have been completed have demonstrated that this would be a tremendous economic boost to this area, putting over 1,000 Virginians back to work and contribute over $135 million annually to the economy. This is a real game changer for Southside Virginia economically.
The General Assembly may or may not do something on the moratorium this session. We're hearing now that they may just postpone it, not even deal with it this year. Do you have any notion, any insight into what might happen in Richmond over the next couple of months?
No, I don't. And I think that it's, you know, it is important to recognize the foundation, the body of evidence that the legislature has at their disposal to consider this important topic, that we have studies from the 1980s making a recommendation to lift the moratorium and establish a regulatory framework. And then I think that the National Academy of Sciences study doesn't say it that directly, but it points to a need to establish a regulatory framework at many points in the report. And so I think that that's a challenge that the Commonwealth and the Virginia legislature will have to wrestle with. Are those recommendations over a 30-year period sufficient to move forward with the promulgation of regulations? And let's keep in mind that that's exactly what lifting the moratorium would do. It would not allow uranium mining. It would allow the rules of the game for uranium mining to be written, and then the burden would be on Virginia Uranium to make sure that we can play by the rules and demonstrate that we can.
Is there anything in the National Academy report that you disagree with?
I don't know that it was disagreeing. I don't know that there were any tremendous surprises. I guess if I had to have one criticism of the report, it would be that they did not, in my opinion, marry up the discussion on the risks with the mitigation techniques. And so they spend, you know, a substantial amount of time talking about the risks associated with the industry, everything from radon gas to hearing protection. And then, in the Chapter 8 of the report, they actually do describe all those mitigation techniques and how they have been proven to be effective. And so I think that that's something that was encouraging to us, that the mitigation techniques, the best management practices are clearly in there. I think that for the reader, though, it might be a little bit easier to understand how those two things connect if they were together. But overall, it was a comprehensive report, and I think that we were pleased, and especially pleased in the roadmap that's laid out for the Commonwealth to proceed with developing regulations so that we can operate the safest uranium mine and mill in the world, and that's what we're committed to. I just would like to also focus on the other studies that have been completed. You know, there have been several socioeconomic studies that have recently been completed, and they all demonstrate that this would be a tremendous economic benefit for Southside Virginia. You know, we would employ over 300 employees with an average salary of $65,000 a year. The spin-off in jobs that would be created by this operation, both socioeconomic studies indicate, would be well over 900 to 1,000 employees supported by our operations. You know, this may very well be the opportunity that we've been waiting for decades in Southside Virginia to positively transform our economy and get it jump-started and get headed in the right direction, because there's an unfortunate reality. The industries that have sustained us for hundreds of years, tobacco and textiles and furniture manufacturing, by and large, those industries are gone, and the reality is that those industries are not coming back. And so, once again, we can use the resources that are in the ground here in Pennsylvania County. They're ours. These jobs can't be shipped overseas. And as we look to address many of the challenges, both economically and from an energy perspective of our generation, I think that we might realize the answers to those challenges are right beneath our feet.
Patrick Wales is a project manager for Virginia Uranium, which hopes to open a uranium mine in Pennsylvania County. This is Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. One note I will pass along. We had hoped to have your phone calls on the air tonight, get some of your thoughts and opinions on the General Assembly. Unfortunately, we've had a slight technical problem here, and it is slight, but slight though it is, it's enough to make it, at least at the moment, impossible for us to take any of your phone calls, so we apologize for that. But if you're not able to call tonight, then by all means make a note to call next week when Governor Bob McDonnell will be our guest on Assembly Conversations. Governor McDonnell has proposed repealing the state law that requires schools to open after Labor Day unless the school division gets a waiver. The tourism industry had supported the law because it gave families one more opportunity to vacation before school starts, and teens would still be available to work at amusement parks and other tourist spots. But the governor says 77 out of 132 school divisions already have waivers to open before Labor Day.
I would hope that as they make those decisions that they would absolutely keep in mind the needs of the business community and the tourism industry so that that is a factor in determining whether in any particular locality that is a prudent course of action. Our goal over time, though, and we will start with aspirational language this year, is to try to extend the school day and extend the school year. It's what's happening all over the world to make young people more competitive. That is a costly proposition and is something that we're going to have to work on over time.
The proposal is just one part of a large package of education bills the governor rolled out. Other bills include establishing more dual enrollment opportunities for high school students to take community college courses, additional funding for elementary level reading intervention, requiring an annual contract and review for teachers instead of continuing contracts, and also tax credits for businesses that contribute to a scholarship fund for low-income children to attend private schools. More quality assessment, not more tests, is one goal supported by members of the Virginia Association of School Superintendents. It's one of five goals put forth by the organization in its first blueprint for the future of education in the Commonwealth. Bedford County School Superintendent Doug Shook says measuring student growth should be more than just taking multiple choice tests.
What you would see through the assessment piece and also the college and career readiness goals is making sure that our students have a capacity to get out there and compete for those jobs that we know right now is a challenge for us to compete with using the tools that we've had in the past.
Shook says instead of being reactive to various education changes being discussed from a variety of sources, the superintendents decided to come up with their own plan.
And I think if you look at Bedford County's strategic plan or the plans for the surrounding districts, you'll see a lot of the same elements that are in this vast blueprint, which is reassuring.
Other goals include getting students ready for college and the workplace, using various styles of teaching to fit students' needs, improving the recruitment and retention of teachers and staff, and increasing state funding for public education, which will be one of their goals in this year's General Assembly session. I'm Fred Eccles. You're listening to Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Ira Agricola is Executive Vice President for Governmental Affairs for the Hampton Roads Chamber of Commerce. He says in his part of Virginia, there is one issue that's always critical.
Hampton Roads as a region is very challenged geographically. We're at the end of the cul-de-sac, and we have a number of river crossings that are very expensive to build new and also very expensive to maintain. So transportation infrastructure has been the number one legislative priority for the Hampton Roads Chamber for a number of years, and we look for continuing strides, you know, in that area this year as well, with more money from the governor's proposed budget, from sales tax going into highway maintenance.
He says they're also closely watching efforts to open a uranium mine in Pennsylvania County upstream from Hampton Roads.
Well, we're very interested in that topic. I don't think we're afraid of the science, but certainly there's a number of concerns relative to the water supply with Gaston and with cities of Suffolk, Chesapeake, and Virginia Beach so dependent on that water supply. We would like to see the Virginia General Assembly really take a cautious approach. I think it's a pretty well-known and accepted premise that they're going to have to stand up an entire department in the Department of Environmental Quality just to regulate uranium mining. You know, we're not prepared to regulate it. And from that perspective, certainly we want to proceed cautiously before any moratorium is lifted.
And Agricola and his colleagues worry about another issue that most Virginia localities don't have to give much thought to, and that is a rising sea level.
Well, it is related to global warming. I'm not the scientific expert, but in a nutshell, it's related to climate change, and it is something that's going to require a significant investment in communities like Hampton Roads, from shipyards to municipalities that maintain sewer systems and stormwater systems, and certainly any rise in the sea level, would impact all of that type of operation. So even though it's a long-term planning issue, it's something that is on the radar screen of Hampton Roads, and and we're continuing to look at the scientific data that supports it.
That's Ira Agricola. He's with the Hampton Roads Chamber of Commerce. This is Assembly Conversations. I'm Fred Eccles. A reminder that next week, Governor Bob McDonnell will be our guest on Assembly Conversations. So questions you have for the governor, be sure and make a note that you'll be able to call him on the program next week.
Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, supporting public discourse through sponsorship of Virginia Public Radio. Resources for parents and teachers online at veanea.org. More information about Assembly Conversations and other Virginia Public Radio programming can be found online at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.